for all its charms, the island of Utopia is uninhabited, and the faint footprints scattered on its beaches turn without exception to the sea. As if all you can do here is leave and plunge, never to return into the depths, into unfathomable life. It was Thomas More who created the word utopia, 1516. You can have that for your trivia later today. Utopia, from two Greek words meaning no place, no place. Still, and throughout human history, we find utopian visions everywhere. The Garden of Eden, the Analects of Confucius, Plato's Republic, the socialist visions of the young Karl Marx. America itself has hosted and still hosts hundreds of utopian communities. So many dreams played out of the longing for a world where everything not only is, but will be okay. The 20th century German philosopher Ernst Bloch argued that the utopian impulse is innately human. Without it, he said, we would be unable to think about the future at all. Did anybody besides me grow up reading fairy tales that ended with the assurance they lived happily ever after? Anybody make marriage vows till death do us part? Anybody do that twice? Confucius said it, when perfect order prevails, the world is like a home shared by all. And of course, the assumption is that that's a perfectly functional home, a loving, a happy home with, as Confucius put it, quote, a sense of sharing, displacing the effects of selfishness. The poet said it. The island of Utopia is uninhabited, and the faint footsteps scattered on its beaches turn without exception to the sea. Has anybody here read Ursula Le Guin's short story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas? Oh, good, Helen. I'm glad someone else has read it. Omelas is a utopia. Everyone has everything they can possibly want. The architecture is magnificent. The weather is perfect. There is no hunger, no violence, no injustice, no guilt. Omelas is perfect, except for this one little thing. Everybody knows about it, but nobody talks about it. There's one little girl locked up in a dirty, windowless cellar. And it is on her incarceration that the whole society depends. She's in there with nothing more than a bucket and two dirty mops. Every Omelan learns about her in school. They take field trips to look at her, for heaven's sakes. But nobody talks about it. In Le Guin's words, every Omelan understands that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the health of their children, even the abundance of their harvest, and the kindly weather of their skies depends wholly on this child's abominable misery. Like most of us, most of the time, Omelans turn away from what they know. Their daily lives are contingent on denial. Utopias always have to be that way. No matter how it is shaped, no matter how beautiful or enticing, every utopian vision requires us to deny something, to set it aside as though it has never been. When we're reading about the handsome prince, it is our cynicism we're asked to abandon, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. But when we move beyond fairy tales, the cost goes up. We must disengage from reality to buy into any form of utopian dream. Recall the American religious experiment known as the Shakers. You may have sung the Shaker worship song, "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple," or you may know their famous vegetable and flower seeds, or maybe you own some beautiful shaker baskets or simple furniture. Maybe there's some left over in the yard sale downstairs. The founder of the Shakers, Mother Ann Lee, was convinced the world was totally corrupt. She called men and women into celibate communities as a saving remnant, a strict alternative to the spiritual dangers of the world. And from the 18th century until our own, as many as 20,000 people lived under the Shaker discipline of hands to work and hearts to God. Some years ago, Peter and I visited the Shaker village at Pleasant Hill, Kentucky. We dined overly well in the refectory. They feed you like there was never going to be another meal in your life. And then we were directed to the dormitories that once housed dozens of believers. Our room had a double bed, but prominently displayed right over the bed was a replica of the Shaker's rules for visitors, and it warned, "Married persons tarrying overnight are respectfully notified that each sex will occupy separate sleeping apartments while they remain. The rule," said the notice right over our double bed, "this rule will not be departed from under any circumstances." Oops. American history is rich, though, with these usually short-lived experiments. Zion in Ohio, New Harmony in Indiana. Everywhere I live, I go visiting these places. You may have been to the Moravian community in Salem. Anybody been to Soul City in Warren County? That one's interesting. I'll let you check it out yourselves. Google it, Soul City. Yesterday, I Googled just intentional communities, utopian communities in North Carolina, and there are 56 of them that are currently connected enough to the internet to register what they're about. Everything ranging from co-housing, which is a form of utopia, to off-the-grid communes that tell you exactly what you have to wear and what you have to believe. But then at another extreme, there's something that intrigues me. It's called The World. It's a cruise ship. It offers a permanent utopia in the form of endless cruising for millionaires and beyond. You want to get on it, you take a helicopter. You want to get off, you do the same. It's just out there, cruising around. What all these groups have in common is their intention to separate from the world, to create a society where their members will live happily ever after if they follow the rules and believe. Utopias are seductive. In addition to helping us dream, helping us conceptualize a better future, they reinforce our longing. And don't tell me you've never had this longing for a life that's problem-free. They tantalize us with the fiction that life's variables can be controlled. And they imply that if anything's left over, we can turn our backs on it or wish it away. For me, at this point, I keep thinking there's something in the utopian dream of America that's requiring us to turn our backs on the 50,000 children that are at the border. Utopias require us to ignore something. Our own Unitarianism has utopian roots. This is something we don't much think about. 16th century Poland, some of you have heard me talk about these folks before. The group called the Minor Reformed Church, who set themselves up in opposition to the theocratic state. Try that one quickly. They formed a utopian town called Raków, R-A-K-O-W. Anybody been there? I haven't either. But they formed a utopian town called Raków, where labor was shared by all and men and women had equal rights. They insisted that people should have religious freedom, including the freedom not to accept the Trinity, and they withdrew into their town so they could live with others, what we sometimes call lived with like-minded individuals. So far, so good. Good deal. Until the king learned that the people of Raków weren't baptizing their babies into the religion of the state. Oops. The king learned that some of Raków's young men were becoming what we would call conscientious objectors. So The king sent soldiers. Blood flowed in the streets. The survivors lost their land and their liberty. And all that's left is a little plaque in the town square in Raqqouf to remind us that without those idealistic Poles, we might not be here today. Their utopian dream was religious freedom. But ultimately, it was grounded in the same fallacy as Ursula Le Guin's Omela, the belief that separation is possible, whether it's in the radical faith of the Polish Brethren or the economic separation of today's gated communities. What has been denied will not go away. What has been denied will not go away. Whether by explosion or erosion, the world must be engaged. As Martin Luther King Jr. put it, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, and reality cannot be held over long at bay. I'm thinking this may be the awareness that's produced the growing body of work known as dystopias, the possible futures that attract darkly, sort of like, you know, when you've got a sore tooth and you want to wiggle it. I want to get the correct name. Virginia Roth, the Divergent series. Anybody read those? They're young adult. Helen, surely you've read those. No. Well, this is worth a whole sermon on its own, but the Divergent series is based on a society where it is believed firmly that diversity can be controlled, and they divide people according to four different character traits. And you're one or the other for your whole life. Except diversity won't go away. But that's the story, and there's three whole books that I encourage you to read. But you've also got, some of us may have read Huxley's Brave New World, a dystopia. Fahrenheit 451 by Bradbury. Suzanne Collins's Hunger Games. Some of you may have read the 1992 novel by P.D. James. I'm not going to ask. I feel like I'm embarrassing people. The 1992 novel by P.D. James, but it was made into a movie called Children of Men. It was set in a future where human beings have lost the ability to reproduce. It was 18 years since the last kid had been born, and humanity was obviously on the brink of extinction. And anarchy was loosed on the world that remains. Except in England. In England, a brutal dictatorship kept the masses in check, all so that a tiny elite could die in peace. It's a dark and, please God, it's an improbable tale, and yet, like most science fiction, it hinges on one tiny premise. The assumption that without hope, human society, humane society, cannot survive. Without hope, humane society cannot survive. Dystopic vision says the world is corrupt, going to hell in a handbasket is the phrase, and it must be changed, converted, if necessary, destroyed. Well, in one form or another, dystopia undergirds evangelical traditions, fundamentalisms of both right and left. You see it in the history of Hitler, of Stalin, and you find it in the radical faith and politics of today. But voices here have not always been demonic. You can look at that. You can see that in Martin Luther King. You can see it in Gandhi when he walked to the sea. But more often what you get are people who are asked, ordinary people, people like you and me, who are presented with a vision, asked to believe it, asked to leave our intellects out the door. When the world is going to hell and you passionately believe that you have the answer, that's capital T, capital A, the answer, your options shut down. Thinking stops. And there is only one true way. And if you think this is all about the other guys, you're not hearing me. Take care, my friends. Take care when you hear a proposal, any proposal, for one true way for the world to be saved. Take care when you lose sight of the complexities of the positions with which you disagree. Take care, because intended or not, you are backing into dystopian thinking. Hell is real, and boy, do I know how the world can be saved. Take care when you find yourself longing for an enclave, a community of like-minded individuals, because you're standing on the edge of utopianism. We'll be fine here if we can just make the world go away. My point is that there's a problem with both of these memes. Both utopian and dystopian visions insist that they have the answers that we need. The fix-it solutions to create an ever after, well, if not just happy, at least righteous dreams. There are, of course, parallels here with contemporary advertising, because every time I read a magazine or open my iPad or go for a drive, I'm surrounded by messages that tell me what I need. Buy me and you'll be happy. Drink me and you'll be popular. Eat me, wear me, drive me. The not so subtle subtext is that I'm broken, I am tremendously flawed, but with the right advice, the right leadership, I can be redeemed. I'm General Motors, Pepsi-Cola, Williams-Sonoma, and I'll be your savior for today. But there's still that kid in the basement. Remember, the omelas. Still the reality of our world. There's sweatshop labor, factory farms, hidden slavery, radical poverty, water shortages, incarcerated children. People still get sick, jobs get lost, investments tank. I can try to ignore it, but the world ain't gonna go away. Remember the words of the poet. For all its charms, the island of utopia is uninhabited, and the faint footprints scattered on its beaches turn without exception to the sea. As if all you can do here is leave and plunge, never to return, into the depths, into unfathomable life. The challenge. The challenge, you see, that is it. How do we plunge into unfathomable life? How do we do it when our bodies aren't working quite as well as they used to, or when there's this and that going on? How do we remain engaged with the world without succumbing to cynicism or abandoning hope? Because I admit it, it is tempting to see brokenness as an existential condition and the world as going to hell regardless of our pain. It is tempting to believe that righteousness will save us, yes, us, that we have the corner on theological or atheological sanity. Oh, come on, some of you have been there. That we've got the corner on environmental convictions or the just and ethical ways of living our days. My friends, Camelot is a myth. As soon as you get close to it, the fairy tale castle fades. Warts and zits show up on the handsome prince or princess. And you know, frogs do look more attractive when you live with them every day. There isn't going to be any utopia. No happy ever after. There never was meant to be. But neither need there be a dystopia. We do not need to. We must not step onto the slippery slope of despair. Our challenge is to release the metaphorical child from the basement of our collective repressed despair. Our challenge is to release the dream that we will do this or that. We'll finally get it right. Finally get life's variables under control. Our challenge, my friends, is to claim our true vocation as human beings and to love openly and honestly and without reservation, truly to love our broken and beautiful world. That's our challenge. It's yours, and it's mine, every single day.